Kansas City, the Twin Cities, the whole of the Midwest, in short, nearly every standing thing would be flattened or on fire, and nearly every living thing would be dead. People up to 1,000 miles away would be knocked off their feet and sliced or clobbered by a blizzard of flying projectiles. Beyond 1,000 miles, the devastation from the blast would gradually diminish. But that's just the initial shockwave. No one can do more than guess what the associated damage would be, other than that it would be brisk and global. The impact would almost certainly set off a chain of devastating earthquakes. Volcanoes across the globe would begin to rumble and spew. Tsunamis would rise up and head devastatingly for distant shores. Within an hour, a cloud of blackness would cover the planet, and burning rock and other debris would be pelting down everywhere, setting much of the planet ablaze. It has been estimated that at least 1.5 billion people would be dead by the end of the first day. The massive disturbances to the ionosphere would knock out communication systems everywhere, so survivors would have no idea what was happening elsewhere or where to turn. It would hardly matter. As one commentator has put it, fleeing would mean selecting a slow death over a quick one. The death toll would be very little affected by any plausible relocation effort, since Earth's ability to support life would be universally diminished. The amount of soot and floating ash from the impact and following fires would blot out the sun, certainly for months, possibly for years, disrupting growing cycles. In 2001, researchers at the California Institute of Technology analyzed helium isotopes from sediments left from the later KT impact and concluded that it affected Earth's climate for about 10,000 years. This was actually used as evidence to support the notion that the extinction of dinosaurs was swift and emphatic. And so it was, in geological terms. We can only guess how well, or whether, humanity would cope with such an event. And in all likelihood, remember, this would come without warning out of a clear sky. But let's assume we did see the object coming. What would we do? Everyone assumes we would send up a nuclear warhead and blast it to smithereens. The idea has some problems, however. First, as John S. Lewis notes, our missiles are not designed for space work. They haven't the oomph to escape Earth's gravity, and even if they did, there are no mechanisms to guide them across tens of millions of miles of space. Still less could we send up a shipload of space cowboys to do the job for us, as in the movie Armageddon. We no longer possess a rocket powerful enough to send humans even as far as the moon. The last rocket that could, Saturn V, was retired years ago and has never been replaced. Nor could we quickly build a new one because, amazingly, the plans for Saturn launches were destroyed as part of a NASA housecleaning exercise. Even if we did manage somehow to get a warhead to the asteroid and blasted it to pieces, the chances are that we would simply turn it into a string of rocks that would slam into us one after the other in the manner of Comet Shoemaker-Levy on Jupiter. But with the difference that now the rocks would be intensely radioactive. Tom Gerrels, an asteroid hunter at the University of Arizona, thinks that even a year's warning would probably be insufficient to take appropriate action. The greater likelihood, however, is that we wouldn't see any object, even a comet, until it was about 6 months away, which would be much too late. Shoemaker-Levy 9 had been orbiting Jupiter in a fairly conspicuous manner since 1929, but it took over half a century before anyone noticed. Interestingly, because these things are so difficult to compute and must incorporate such a significant margin of error, even if we knew an object was heading our way, we wouldn't know until nearly the end, the last couple of weeks anyway, whether collision was certain. For most of the time of the object's approach, we would exist in a kind of cone of uncertainty. It would certainly be the most interesting few months in the history of the world. And imagine the party if it passed safely. So how often does something like the Manson impact happen? I asked Anderson and Witski before leaving. Oh, about once every million years on average, said Witski. And remember, added Anderson, this was a relatively minor event. Do you know how many extinctions were associated with the Manson impact? No idea, I replied. None, he said, with a strange air of satisfaction. Not one. Of course, Witski and Anderson added hastily and more or less in unison, there would have been terrible devastation across much of the Earth, as just described, and complete annihilation for hundreds of miles around Ground Zero. But life is hardy, and when the smoke cleared, there were enough lucky survivors from every species that none permanently perished. The good news, it appears, is that it takes an awful lot to extinguish a species. The bad news is that the good news can never be counted on. Worse still, it isn't actually necessary to look to space for petrifying danger. As we are about to see, Earth can provide plenty of danger of its own. 14. The Fire Below. In the summer of 1971, a young geologist named Mike Voorhees was scouting around on some grassy farmland in eastern Nebraska, not far from the little town of Orchard, where he had grown up. Passing through a steep-sided gully, he spotted a curious glint in the brush above and clambered up to have a look. What he had seen was the perfectly preserved skull of a young rhinoceros, which had been washed out by recent heavy rains. A few yards beyond, it turned out, was one of the most extraordinary fossil beds ever discovered in North America, a dried-up waterhole that had served as a mass grave for scores of animals, rhinoceroses, zebra-like horses, saber-toothed deer, camels, turtles. All had died from some mysterious cataclysm just under 12 million years ago, in a time known to geology as the Miocene. In those days, Nebraska stood on a vast, hot plain, very like the Serengeti of Africa today. The animals had been found buried under volcanic ash up to 10 feet deep. The puzzle of it was that there were not, and never had been, any volcanoes in Nebraska. Today, the site of Voorhees' discovery is called Ashfall Fossil Beds State Park, and it has a stylish new visitor center and museum with thoughtful displays on the geology of Nebraska and the history of the fossil beds. The center incorporates a lab with a glass wall through which visitors can watch paleontologists cleaning bones. Working alone in the lab on the morning I passed through was a cheerfully grizzled-looking fellow in a blue work shirt whom I recognized as Mike Voorhees from a BBC television documentary in which he featured. They don't get a huge number of visitors to Ashfall Fossil Beds State Park. It's slightly in the middle of nowhere, and Voorhees seemed pleased to show me around. He took me to the spot atop a 20-foot ravine where he had made his find. "It was a dumb place to look for bones," he said happily. "But I wasn't looking for bones. I was thinking of making..."